As the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip enters its 164th day, Doctors Without Borders says the situation in the territory is catastrophic and words cannot describe it. There are reports of dozens of casualties as Israeli forces launch another attack on Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital, where thousands of displaced Palestinians have taken shelter. Also coming up, Russia's Election Commission says a record number of voters cast their ballots in the country's three-day presidential poll, handing a resounding victory to the incumbent President Putin. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The Gaza Strip is enduring relentless Israeli airstrikes and shelling as more Palestinians have lost their lives in fresh attacks. The regime has targeted several areas near the southern city of Khan Yunis. They include Hamad Town, where five dead bodies were recovered from under the rubble. Israeli warplanes also struck some neighborhoods in Gaza City and its vicinity. The regime shelled east of the Barej refugee camp and targeted homes in the Nuseirat camp in central Gaza as well. That led to the killing of several Palestinians. Israel unleashed its war in Gaza in early October. Over 31,700 Palestinians have been killed so far. The war rages on, while Gazans are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid severe food shortages. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says people in the coastal Sibla are on the brink of famine. Doctors Without Borders also say that the current situation in Gaza is catastrophic and indescribable. Israel has launched a fresh operation against Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, which is sheltering tens of thousands of Palestinians displaced by the regime's onslaught. Witnesses in Gaza City say tanks surround the hospital site and nearby areas have been bombed. Gaza's health ministry says it has received information that shows that there are dozens of casualties. The Hamas resistance movement has called the storming of Al-Shifa Hospital a war crime. The Israeli military has carried out multiple operations in and around medical facilities across the Gaza Strip since the start of its genocide on October 7. According to the UN, 155 health facilities in the Gaza Strip have been damaged since then. Let's get the latest on what's happening there in the Gaza Strip. Muti Abu Musaba is our correspondent joining us from Deir al-Balah. Well, Muti, tell us what you have, and in particular, what is the latest on the Al-Shifa Hospital and the operations there by the regime forces?
Yes, actually, as you know, that the Israeli occupation forces conducted a blitz offensive against the Al-Shifa medical complex over the last night, where hundreds of the Israeli tanks and the Israeli forces moved in a swift attack against the compound. Amid the heavy gunfire and continuous bombardments, at least 40 consecutive Israeli airstrikes hit the compound, the buildings, the yards, and even the surrounding areas of the Al-Shifa compound. Knowing that thousands of the Palestinian civilians are taking shelter in the hospital, in addition to the paramedics and the medical staff and the Palestinian injuries who actually are located there receiving the needed medical care, the Israeli occupation attack actually left thousands of the Palestinian civilians killed and injuries, in addition to the big fire that blazed in the surgery department in one building, in a building inside the compound. In addition to that, even the surrounding areas were subjected to heavy bombardments of the Israeli continuous attacks, and even as you know, that there are several schools taking shelter by the Palestinian evacuees. They were invaded by the Israeli occupation forces. Hundreds of the Palestinian civilians, the Palestinian men, and the Palestinian young men were abducted and kidnapped by the Israeli occupation forces, where the women and the girls were demanded by the Israeli occupation forces to flee, to go to the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly Deir al-Balah city here in the central area of Gaza Strip. At the same time, more residential areas and neighborhoods were hit staunchly by the continuous and the chronic Israeli airstrikes. We are talking about Al-Zaytun and Al-Daraj, Al-Tufah, Tal al-Hawa, Al-Rimal neighborhoods. They were under heavy bombardments of the Israeli airstrikes. Dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings were destroyed and leveled to the ground, leaving dozens of the Palestinian casualties. These airstrikes and these attacks are still underway. so far. As we speak right now, it was reported that more Israeli strikes are still hitting those areas. The current situation is hyper-hazardous in Gaza City. It is subjected to a brutal Israeli aggression that is targeting the Palestinian civilians there, the Palestinian residential areas. As I've mentioned, dozens of the Palestinian buildings were pounded by the continuous Israeli strikes, where thousands of the Palestinian civilians also were demanded to flee from their residential buildings and their areas. And when it comes to the central area of Gaza Strip, the situation is still catastrophic as well, as the Israeli occupation forces maintain their strikes and incursions against the central area, particularly Nusayrat refugee camp, whereas over the last night, the Israeli warplanes destroyed another residential building, claiming the lives of 9 Palestinian civilians. Most of them were children and women. These airstrikes are continued, and even over the last couple of hours, the Israeli artillery maintained its shelling towards the eastern part of Deir el-Balah city. And when it comes to Khan Yunis city, Al-Mawasi area, which is claimed by the Israeli occupation forces as a safe area, it was under a repetitive Israeli attack. Once again, the Israeli artillery and the Israeli helicopters and the Israeli military boats actually opened the gunfire towards the tents of the displaced Palestinians there. We are witnessing a real and a significant Israeli escalation taking place these moments in Gaza Strip. Over to you.
Thank you very much for that, and thanks for clarifying that for us. That's Muti Abdul Musaba, a correspondent there from Deir al-Balah. Be safe. Thank you, Muti. Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar has called for a ceasefire in Gaza, saying that Palestinians need the Israeli bombs to stop. Varadkar said that Gazans desperately need food, medicine, and shelter. He also said that Irish people are deeply troubled about the catastrophe that is unfolding before their eyes in Gaza. The Premier also called on the U.S. to secure a truce and to create space for lasting peace. He made the comments during a meeting with the U.S. President at the White House. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has also raised the alarm over the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip, calling for an immediate ceasefire in the territory.
We are all extremely concerned about the war in Gaza and the unfolding catastrophic humanitarian situation. Gaza is facing famine, and we cannot accept this. It is critical to achieve an agreement on a ceasefire rapidly now that frees the hostages and allows more humanitarian aid to reach Gaza.
Von der Leyen also voiced concern about Israel's threat for a full-scale offensive in the southern Gaza city of Rafah. She said it would have a devastating impact on the civilian population. She made the comments in a joint presser with the Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Cairo. Sisi also opposed any Israeli ground operation in Rafah that would further deteriorate the humanitarian crisis. He also underlined Egypt's opposition to any Israeli attempt to forcibly displace Palestinians from their homes. People in different countries across the globe continue to voice solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. In the Netherlands capital, hundreds of pro-Palestine demonstrators gathered outside of the National Holocaust Museum for the second time since last week. The demonstration came as a delegation from the Israeli regime was visiting the National Holocaust Museum. Protesters held pictures of the children killed in Israeli bombings in Gaza. They called for an immediate end to the ongoing genocidal war in the besieged strip. In another European capital, London, people displayed their support for the Palestinians during a rally against racism. They called for an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Also in Italy, hundreds of protesters gathered in Milan in support of the Palestinians. The demonstrators held signs reading "Stop the genocide in Gaza" and "Stop arming Israel." The German city of Berlin was also the scene of a massive rally.
Oh. We are here to demonstrate for Palestine, and I think it's not only about Palestine here, it's also about showing our anger towards the German media and the German politicians, because they have a lot of power and they decided to take a side. And even they use sometimes some wars for a human crisis or something like this. I can't believe it. I have the feeling that it's just an empty war.
The protesters demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. They carried blood-stained small-mock body bags in reference to the large number of children killed in Gaza. In Bahrain, which has normalized ties with Israel, the protesters hailed the Palestinian resistance fighters and decried the U.S. for the Israeli bloodletting in Gaza. Also in Chile, South America, a massive rally was held in the capital, Santiago, with protesters denouncing Israel for the killing of over 16,000 children in Gaza. Vladimir Putin has secured a landslide victory in Russia's presidential election, with 99% of the votes counted, winning his fifth term as president.
87,113,127 of our dear voters took part in the election, and that means that the turnout was record high and unprecedented. It has never been as high before. The turnout is 77.44%.
Russia's election commission also hailed Putin's victory as an unprecedented post-Soviet record, with each of Putin's three other rivals getting less than 5% of the votes. The election was held over 3 days for the first time in Russia's history. The win gives Putin another 6 years in office as president. Iran and China have already sent congratulatory messages to Moscow on Putin's re-election. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin has issued a warning to the West over the Ukraine war shortly after early results of Russia's presidential election showed that he will remain in power. Putin says the presence of Western troops in Ukraine can put the world on the verge of World War III. Putin also touched upon peace talks over Ukraine. He expressed Russia's readiness for talks on a French proposal for a ceasefire during this summer's Olympic Games. However, Putin said that he will take into account Russia's interests on the front line of the war. The president added that Russian armed forces hold the initiative on the battlefield as they have made advances in Ukraine. On Saturday, the French president said that his country will ask Moscow to observe a ceasefire in Ukraine during the Olympic Games, where Russian athletes are banned to compete under their country's flag. Moving on with the news, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has launched multiple short-range ballistic missiles amid growing tensions in the Korean Peninsula. South Korea's Joint Chief of Staff says it detected the launches early on Monday. It says the missiles flew around 300 kilometers before coming down in the waters east of the Korean Peninsula. The new development comes as the U.S. Secretary of State is in South Korea for talks. Washington and Seoul wrapped up their latest joint war games last week. Pyongyang considers such drills rehearsals for invasion. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, says many people around the globe miss the real news on the Korean Peninsula due to a lack of access to objective media.
There are other exercises that are taking place in just a few days this week that the press has been invited to. For South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, who restarted these war games and strengthened the alliance with the U.S., brought in more so-called strategic assets. These are U.S. weapons capable of delivering a nuclear strike against North Korea. It's hard to really argue with North Korea's analysis of this when some of these drills involve bridge crossings and amphibious landings and simulated decapitation strikes aimed at North Korean leadership. It's hard to argue that these are really provocative in nature, and that North Korea is responding to these drills rather than the U.S. and South Korea spin of this, that it's the U.S. that it's North Korea that's fomenting conflict, that's fomenting an arms race in the region, with, again, South Korea increasing its import of U.S. arms, including 20 more Joint Strike F-35 fighter jets that they just ordered. So again, it's how this is being spun, really, for an international community that sometimes is missing the mark, not really, you know, having access to more objective media, I believe.
For the third year in a row, Afghanistan has been declared the least happy country in the world. That's according to the UN's World Happiness Report. Rahmatullah Bagban has more from Kabul.
The people of Afghanistan are facing immense hardship and sorrow, with the country finding itself at the bottom of the World Happiness Report rankings. The report, which evaluates nations based on various factors such as freedom, health, and income, has named Afghanistan as the unhappiest, where almost everyone is very unhappy.
Everyone here agrees with the result of the World Happiness Survey. We are unhappiest, and that is because of the ongoing poverty, unemployment, and lack of freedom and opportunities. Furthermore, girls cannot receive education, which further adds to the misery of Afghan families. When women are despaired, families feel unhappy.
I have been unemployed for almost 3 years. Since then, I have not had any income. My young daughters are missing their school, and this situation is so tough. How can we be happy?
The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
As we speak, mental clinics across Kabul are receiving more patients than ever. As a psychologist, I witnessed the rise of mental health problems such as anxiety, stress, and depression. They have even led to suicide. If you take hope away from people, it will result in a depressed and dead nation. Hope is everything for human beings. If it is eroded, all progress will be lost.
The Afghan people are resilient, but the absence of basic human necessities and rights can crush even the strongest will. The international community and the ruling Taliban share a responsibility to bring some hope and light to the life of the crisis-stricken nation. Decades of foreign interventions and war have made Afghans the poorest and the saddest people on the planet. This nation has long yearned for peace and happiness, but it remains to be seen when or whether they find their lost dream. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
When Israel began its aggression against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, it didn't anticipate the resistance fighters of Hamas to put up such a fight. Now, after 5 months of this onslaught, its economy is doing so poorly that it needs to pull its reservists from the battlefield to help it with its economy while going after more money to continue the genocidal war. Hi, I'm Kavit Ahwai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, we're going to take a look at the Israeli economy, the key sectors that have been affected, also the large GDP drop that was 19.4%, and the lack of investments, which has affected large segments of the society, including the labor shortage. Then, Israel's tech sector, something that has been impacted, slumping before October 7th, however, and the situation just got worse with the Operation Al-Aqsa flood, the value dropping from $17 billion to $7.5 billion when it comes to investments. Political instability also is something that plagued Israel's economy before October 7th. Then the Israeli reservists, what happened? They
had 300,000 that went to the battlefield. Therefore, they were taken out of the workforce. Many were recalled back to contribute to the society, economically and in other respects. But has it helped Israel's economy?
Israel's economy is in crisis mode. Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians in the Gaza Strip has proven more expensive than expected. Between October and December, Israel's economy shrank by a fifth at an annualized rate compared with the previous 3 months. It was more than twice the contraction predicted by the Bank of Israel. In the same period, over 750,000 people, or a sixth of the labor force, were away from work, many of them evacuees or reservists. Moody's, a rating agency, downgraded the regime's credit rating for the first time ever. The tech sector has been hit hard. Many have moved operations abroad. In 2023, the value of Israeli tech exits, including M&As and IPOs, slumped 56% to $7.5 billion from $16.9 billion a year earlier. 2022 was already a tough year for Israel's tech industry, as the uncertain specter of rising interest rates, global stock market fall, and tech layoffs led to a sharp slowdown in investments. Israel attracts most of its tech investments from abroad. About 80% of venture capital investments in local high-tech startups were generated from foreign funds.
Time now to take a look at some of the social media posts on this. First up, we took a look at the topic of boycott. This entry said, boycott and makes a change. Israel's economy is falling to its knees. Then we looked at this entry where we thought it's important. The war may cost them a lot of money that will be paid back from the USA, UK, and the EU because they will support Israel unconditionally. But the major hit is boycotting that. It will hurt them, if not now, later, and the hit will be so hard. Okay, so a couple of topics there on boycott. Next, the US could literally do that. The majority of their economy is funded by the USA. The USA cutting support would be catastrophic for Israel's economy. The U.S. has the power, it's just too incompetent to wield it the right way. Then, how the war in Gaza has hurt Israel's economy. The fight against Hamas will cost £46 billion by the end of next year, while leaving farming, tech, and hospitality short of thousands of workers. And finally, Israel's economy plummets off a cliff amid the Gaza war, what we call it the onslaught. The Bureau attributed the drop in part to the fact that some 300,000 reservists were called up to man the war effort, leaving their day jobs vacant and the civilian economy losing out on a big chunk of both producer activity and consumer spending. Our guest for our first Q&A, let me introduce them. Joe Catrone joins us, Palestine solidarity activist, and it's important to note that he lived in Gaza from the years 2011 through 2014. Joe Catrone, welcome to Economic Divide. So we're looking at, obviously, key sectors of Israel's economy to have suffered as a result of this onslaught. And at the top of the list, construction, tourism, and agriculture. Do you think these sectors can see any signs of improvement given the fact that this onslaught is continuing?
Well, I think that the resistance, of course, led by the Palestinian resistance, but also including forces within the exact axis of resistance fighting from Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq, have done a really masterful job in isolating Israel economically as well as militarily. At this point, it's hard to see how its economy could hope to function in any normal way as long as this onslaught continues. Between the ongoing bombardment in its north, which is preventing the return of settlers, and the complete closure of its shipping lane in the Red Sea, as well, of course, as the ongoing fight resistance it faces from Palestinians in Gaza. Israel is in a war that it can't hope to continue while maintaining any sort of normal economy.
All right, that was Joe Catrone there. Thank you, Joe Catrone. Let me introduce our next guest here. John Phoenix joins us now. John Phoenix is the founder and editor-in-chief at Shoah.org.uk. John Phoenix, welcome to Economic Divide. The different sectors that's been affected by this onslaught, the tech sector is the one that stands out the most. And it's something that's been repeated It was not doing well before the onslaught, however. And, of course, we've seen how they're now doing much worse. Investor confidence is lost in that industry. How can this sector hope for any recuperation? How can they begin to even think that they can attract investments when this onslaught has not only ended, but that it may continue on the political side to impact the sector?
The record show us that the main product on technology was actually promoted in the Europe and parts of the Middle East is the Merkava, their tank, which is proven failing on the front in Gaza. This, obviously, without going through the technical details of the tank, was actually supposed to be an advanced best tank in the world. Turkey ordered 400 of those, which is, if that deal went through, they will have, obviously, revenue of millions of dollars a year. But failing on the ground shows that it's not worth to invest in such technology. The reason I'm giving that example, because this was one of their best, obviously, marketing for the technology. Other factor is due to the crimes and the genocide of Gaza, some companies actually dropped dealing with the Israeli technology due to the obviously claimed to be ethical issues. Such technology being used to slaughter Palestinians in Gaza. So that's two factors together affect their ability to advance any growth on the last, obviously, clearly from the October till about now.
Time now for the Infinite News section of the program. First up, we're going to take a look at U.S. oil sales to China, something that's not going to happen. And it's interesting that this is actually something that the U.S. May have done. But the U.S. Basically has come out and said it could, underline could, ban state oil sales to China from, and this is the interesting part, from the SPR. What's the SPR? Well, that's an emergency stockpile that was created following the West Asia oil embargo of 1973. This sounds like there's a security-related issue regarding trade where the U.S. has come out making this type of a statement. So it's a story that we need to look at a little bit further. On to the EU, our next entry, and the food prices there. The prices of major food staples have spiked up by a lot, 50%. I think that's a lot. For example, olive oil costs across the bloc have been on the rise since mid-2023, and that's according to Eurostat. The EU is still grappling with a food crisis in terms of the inflation and food. And to add that to that, the farmer protest, you can see that that situation is somewhat volatile. Now we go on to a very contentious topic, and this is the green energy. And in particular, in the U.S. that has promoted this, the transition aspect of it. What's slowing down America's clean energy transition is what caught our attention. And this headline read, "It's not the cost." It said a new report has found renewable energy is facing organized opposition, that's right, and grid connectivity issues. So the transformation obviously is not going to be that simple nor easy. Now, our take on this is the only issue is the speed of the transition. In the last 2 years, high inflation and supply chain issues led to temporary price increases. And the reason why we mentioned that is because green transition is supposed to somewhat lower prices also, but that's not going to be the case based on the way that we view it. Now, this piece of news is important. It may not sound economic in flavor, but the Israeli ambassador to Italy has been rejected by Italy. Italy has rejected this person who was a former settlement mayor for the ambassadorial position. Now, Rome did not want an ambassador who was mayor of a West Bank settlement and had also headed the Yesha Council. That's the main political arm of the settlement movement. Why do we think that's important and related to the economy? Because this may be a trend. If you have a country that's rejecting an appointment by Israel of their ambassador, this may spill over into the trade aspect of it, where it may impact trade overall. So we have to wait and see whether this is going to have a contagion effect or not. Those were the news items we picked for our FNews section.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Israel's over 5 months of aggression is taking a toll on its economy. Now, we've established that. In this in-depth section, we will look at some of the key areas which has drained Israel's budget from its funds. First of all, let's take a look at how Israel actually got a reality check when it realized that it had suffered what was a very steep drop in its GDP for the last quarter of 2023, minus 19.4%. And that is a lot by any standards. It highlights the fallout of the ongoing onslaught against the Gaza Strip, and the impact that it had on different sectors. Consumer spending, productivity, you have investment, and also trade, they're all down. So a result of those negative factors has contributed to the negative 19.4%. Next, the large GDP drop was due to the fact that, and we've mentioned this before, I know, but it needs to be highlighted again. You have some 300,000 reservists that left their jobs. That contributed to about 8% of the workforce that was taken out of the economic cycle. And now 8% of the workforce out of the economic cycle, producer activity also, obviously is being affected, consumer spending has been affected, and then when you branch those out, you have consumption and Israel spending. The two that we picked were consumption has dropped by 27%. And then you have the spending by Israel itself, which has gone up 88%. So you see obviously how Israel's economy is going to suffer, is suffering as a result of this aggression. Now we're going to take a look at the labor force disruption in terms of the evacuees. And I know, again, this is something we've mentioned, but 120,000 is the latest figures that we have. Again, these are contributing to the large GDP drop, taken out of the workforce, and then the Palestinian workers. We have 170,000 of them taken out of the workforce. That's a drop, obviously, in also the Palestinian economy. That gets impacted. Construction projects is mainly what we're looking at being one of the top sectors that has been impacted by this. Next up, this concerns trade. Obviously, imports and exports is at the top of the list. You have imports to have been negatively affected, and that's a big a drop of minus 42%, and exports at this point minus 18%. Again, you're seeing a big chunk of the Israeli economy to be impacted. And then you have the Yemeni army that's targeting U.S., U.K., and Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea, and that disruption has also led to a drop in Israel's GDP and its economy as a whole. And then finally, this is very important, the downgrade that happened, and it happened a few weeks back, where it affected Israel's credit rating from A1 to A2, and the organization responsible for that is a big ratings agency by the name of Moody's. Now, when this happens, the ability to repay debt is what is put under the spotlight in terms of Israel. And obviously, the sovereign debt outlook has now been downgraded to negative. So when you have this happening, it makes it very hard for Israel to borrow money, in short, money that is needed for them if they want to continue with their onslaught. The finance minister has said this did not include serious economic claims, but many economists actually disagree with the stance that he has had, somewhat similar to what the stance of the Israeli Prime Minister has been. All right, let's bring back our guest for this segment of the program. We have Joe Catron, who's rejoining us. He's He's a Palestine Solidarity activist, and he lived in Gaza from 2011 through 2014. Joe Cotrone, welcome back to Economic Divide. You know, this decision to bring back the reservists from the battle lines, it was seen as a positive move by Israel because they say that they're going to contribute to Israel's economy. But since most of them are in the tech sector, which is doing that badly, how much can this move actually help Israel's economy, do you think?
Well, I think a lack of tech workers is the least of Israel's problems right now. The far bigger problem it faces is, first of all, its military challenge from the resistance on every front, from Gaza and the West Bank to Lebanon, Yemen, and Syria, as well as the increasing political, economic, and diplomatic isolation it faces on a global scale as the direct result of its ongoing atrocities in Gaza. None of its problems will be fixed by shuffling people around. That is no longer an option for it. And in fact, I'm not sure they can be fixed at all, because so much of what Israel had built up, the appearance it had tried to maintain of power, and was based upon a myth that was shattered on October 7th. We all saw how easily it could be challenged and defeated. They're still complaining. They're still whining about this 5 months later, the scale of their defeat. They're no closer to overcoming it. Nothing that they've attempted in the meantime has reversed any of the gains the resistance made. So I don't see any possible solution for them, even to regain some level of modest prosperity, which they had built up, short of ending their genocide, first of all. But beyond that, I don't think they'll return to the status they held prior to October 7th, regardless, because the resistance fundamentally changed the equation. It showed how easily they could be fought and defeated.
All right, thank you very much for that. Let's bring back John Phoenix, now founder and editor-in-chief of Shoah.org.uk. John Phoenix, welcome back. The way that Israel's economy is suffering, one of the solutions that Israel has thought of is to bring back some of these reservists, which comprises of 8% of its economy, the contribution that they make, and their presence in the workforce. Do you think that's going to help its economy at all, especially when it comes to the fact that they work in the tech sector mainly?
Well, if you look at the picture in general, you know, the 300,000 of reserved force being recruited to fight the war, obviously, that kept a lot of the vacuum within the economy, such running the airports, security, hospitals, industry, agriculture. So they're trying to release some of this reserved in order to do the civil, obviously, duty. Teachers being recruited, obviously, doctors, technicians. So the only way to try to recover part of the economy is to try to reserve, to release some of the reserve in order to go for civil duty. And it's doing that is not even improving yet, you know. Now they're calling on the religious sector to join in, if you heard of the last report about the Haredim, you know. They wanted to give them some military work, which is could be not as such as fighting, as maybe running prisons, running security centers. So they are desperate in order to run the same time running a war and running the society. And as I said earlier, the only way these people to recover and survive is to stop the war. Otherwise, they will be in receipt of American aid till the American give up, and then we will have no recovery in the economy. So this is a catch-22, to be honest with you.
The rest of the economy in Israel is in trouble. Construction is at a standstill. Farms have lost more than half of their workforce. In addition, companies involved in tourism are suffering, In January, 77% fewer tourists visited Quds than a year ago. Israel's labor market is already tight. Bringing in foreign workers is slow and expensive. Farms, factories, and building sites lack workers. After October 7th, the regime spent $30 billion in foreign reserves propping up the shekel and has another $170 billion if the currency needs more cushioning. Analysts believe a financial crisis is unlikely, but that does not mean pain will be avoided. It will just come in different forms. There are talks of further spending cuts that are required to guarantee stability. Israel's welfare apparatus will take the hit. The welfare ministry, which is also responsible for caring for evacuees and returned captives, will have to take an 8% cut. Value-added taxes will rise by 1 percentage point to 18%. The health tax on incomes will go up by 0.15 percentage points. Policymakers worry that raising corporate taxes would cause the tech sector, which is highly mobile and already struggling to find workers, to flee the regime.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matt Yaposian. When it comes to Israel's debt, news has surfaced that the occupation entity is gearing towards raising money to keep pace with the required onslaught spending. The Israeli regime is seeking to raise $60 billion in debt this year alone. Obviously, it's running short on funds, and in order to save as much money as possible, it will also freeze hiring and raise taxes because it has almost doubled its aggression spending. We have already mentioned this before, but the need to go out and raise money is a result of the economic and labor force disruptions due to the reservists, settlers, and Palestinian laborers. But what is not covered or discussed much is how many reservists have been pulled from the battlefield. Israel has announced that there are around 60,000 reservists who were still carrying out acts of genocide in Gaza. That means 240,000 reservists were back into the economic cycle. So why is that not improving the economy? On borrowing, this is not the first time the Israeli regime had to go out and borrow. And as long as the aggression continues, it won't be its last time either. In the beginning of the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza, Tel Aviv borrowed $22 billion, which soared the debt-to-GDP ratio up to 62%, the highest for the entity in 8 years. It's also worth looking at how Israel plans to increase military spending overall and what that figure was before the onslaught began. Israel is planning on increasing military spending by $15 billion, marking an 85% increase in military spending from 13% of the military budget before their onslaught against Gaza to 20% in 2024. Okay, that brings us to the end of this Quick Take segment.
The economy of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are unable to recover at the time being due to the continued aggression. Israel's need for loans indicates that it is unable to meet the cost of not only the aggression, but also of its own needs. There's no surprise there, since the aggression was not supposed to last this long. And since there's no end in sight at this time, there are speculations that Israel's major ally, like the U.S., will come to its rescue. From Mikhail Mitavli and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different dimensions of the concept of humanity in the Holy Quran and the teachings that the Holy Quran has in this regard. In the previous episode, we ended up talking about different faculties of the human soul. We talked about the heart, we talked about intellect and reason, and we were talking about the obstacles that stop reason from functioning properly, and one of them was blindly following the tradition or the social habits. Another is blind obedience or blindly following the great ones or the personalities or the figures in the society. And said, according to the verses of the Holy Quran, the verse that reads, on the day of judgment, one excuse that wrongdoers bring for their action is that they say, "Inna ta'na sadatana." It is because we did this because our masters told us to do so, or wakubara'ana, the figures and the like famous popular figures in the society, they told us or they did something and we followed the suit and we did whatever they did. And I said this looks like some elements of it looks like the elements that we see in the cult of personality, that some people, they are so much devoted to a person without any proper reason, sometimes because they have some poverty in their soul, some holes, some problems, some insufficiency of the self, that they find to fill it up with the devotion to another person. This in itself might not be bad, because there are good applications of that as well. And the good application is when you take a role model for yourself. Taking a role model, especially if it is done according to your rational analysis, rational assessment, is something good in all careers, all the things that we do to achieve success. It's very difficult to achieve success without role models. Role models are very good to have. It's no problem. But the problem arises when some people, the role model that they have, for example, let's assume I like soccer, football, and I like this football player very much. But this relationship goes beyond this field of soccer playing, and it goes to other areas of life. Well, I forget that, well, he's a good person in the field, in the soccer field, and he shoots the ball well. I don't know. But doesn't mean he is a good role model in terms of the, I don't know, akhlaq or manners or anything else. And this happens with people, especially the youth, that they sometimes lose the compass that they had because of the devotion, inner devotion that you have to a personality. And they think that whatever that he does or she does, I don't know, based on the celebrity that they have, and pretty much like the cult of personalities, they have fans, as you have heard. And these fans, sometimes they go to the extreme level. And exactly the behaviors that you see in the cult of personality, you see among these fans, so-called fans. And Yes, and sometimes the behavior that they have overflow to society as well. And you see a trend in society that starts because of that such celebrity did something, and then his fans or her fans they continue doing that in the communities. And completely, according to the verses of the Holy Quran, there are some instances of ata'na sadatana wa kubara'ana, just because they're figures, famous, popular, everybody else, without even questioning or critical thinking, follow them. We will have a break and we come back to continue our discussion.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to the program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In the first episode, we were left with a little bit of the discussion that we had in the previous episode about the cult of personality as one obstacle in the way of reason, proper fulfillment of the duties of the reason. And we said sometimes those excuses and empty justifications actually will hinder a person from following what he thinks correct, and it changes the compass of the person to the wrong direction. Another obstacle in the way of reason is conceit and arrogance, according to the verses of the Holy Quran. And these are not actually exclusive, meaning that a person could have all of these together, like blind following of the social habits, blind or devotion to one personality, and at the same time arrogance, which stops a person from rethinking and reconsideration of his behaviors. So the verse of the Holy Quran in this regard reads like this: إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُجَادِلُونَ فِي آيَاتِ اللَّهِ. Those who يُجَادِلُونَ فِي آيَاتِ اللَّهِ, it means that those who fight with the verses of the Holy Quran, or with the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, better to be translated. Ayat means signs. They do jadal, they always argue against the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imagine if you're driving and there's a sign telling you, yes, there's a danger, and you stop and you, start fighting with the sign, trying to destroy it or trying to say, no, this doesn't mean that, this playing with it, arguing it. The sign's function is to help you find your direction. If you start arguing against it, it doesn't help. So, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُجَادِلُونَ فِي آيَاتِ اللَّهِ بِغَيْرِ سُلْطَانٍ أَتَاهُمْ, without any basis, without any sultan, means here means solid evidence. بغير سلطان, without any solid evidence. Just because there's a possibility that the narrative of, I don't know, creation could be different than, it's just a possibility. It's, you don't have solid evidence for that. You don't have solid evidence about anything. Like the claims of Alam al-Ghayb that the Quran makes, we don't have solid evidence. Only because there's a possibility, there's a probability that this is different, it doesn't make your case valid. But they just bring in those possibilities, those probabilities. بغير سلطان, without any, we will talk about it when we talk about conjecture, people who follow conjecture. إِنَّ فِي صُدُورِهِمْ إِلَّا كِبْرٌ مَا هُمْ بِبَالِغِ. They do that only because of the arrogance, because of the conceit, because they want to show themselves as, yes, I'm a person of my own. I'm different. I don't know. So this is kibr. This is to have like attention seeking disorder. To be at the center of the attention of others, always arguing with the truth, always arguing without any sultan, without any solid evidence. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us not to fall into the traps of shaitan, and to help us understand the beautiful teachings of our religion. Thank you very much for listening. Inshallah, until next episode. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Of the soil from the blood and the ashes, it speaks with me the sound of the rain from the battle and the victory.
Hey!